So what made you decide to join Greenham Common?
Okay, I was in CND. I was running the local group in Dorchester. And some Quakers from Dorset Peace Council approached us because they knew the march was coming up from Wales and they wanted to be there offering something when the women arrived at Greenham. And they actually took a caravan. And our CND group in Dorchester was just asked, could we, you know, donate money or publicise it or put in some food and stuff. So we worked with the Dorset Peace Council to get that caravan there.
And how long were you there for and what made you decide to leave?
Yes. My role was, I was in a wheelchair at the time. And I was also a part of that time, I was a full-time teacher. So my role was sort of from the outside in the way because I was in CND and then I became chair of the Dorset Peace Council. So my role really was in Dorset as a satellite of Greenham. And I used to go and do the night watch on a Wednesday at different gates, depending on which one was needing extra people, because we were trying to keep a fire at all the gates every night, partly for safety, partly for vigil. So I was just one of that team, and I went to all the events and used to go up at weekends and stuff like that. But the most I lived there was for about 2 weeks. Is that right?
And so, and how long did you do that for? How long were you associated with
all the time. Because we were there when that first caravan was sent from Dorset. And then because I was then doing the book, you know, we were there right. Now I remember. My mum died and things got cut off then. So I wasn't there right at the end. So I don't know anything about the last phase.
And was it what you expected it to be?
Oh, gosh, that's really difficult. I expected the mud. I expected the roughness. I expected the sort of campingness. You know, you wonder when you hear about it, how are they managing on the edge of a really busy road? You know, cars zooming past all the time. How do you keep yourself together? What I didn't expect was how different women were. That was fascinating to me.
In what way were they different? What did you notice?
Well, my experience in Dorset was that a lot of women were attracted to the Greenham idea because of their children. It was a kind of extension of why they were motivated to be in CND. And it was absolutely to do with cruise missiles, you know, unilateral disarmment. It was specifically connected to defence. But when I kind of got more deeper involved in Greenham, there were lots of projects there, different feminist projects at work behind the whole movement that women were brought together for, which was, well, the cruise missiles, but on a larger scale, disarmament, peace.
So what were some of the other projects going on then underneath all of this?
A lot of lifestyle projects about how women wanted to live. Women wanting to live, wanting to be more empowered in their lives, to have a political position. And there were some, you know, the highly professional women there as well. There were obviously women who wanted to live a purely lesbian life, separatist women. There were bisexual women. What I don't want to do is describe these as sexual choices. This is my dilemma, because it's much more than that. There are political theoretical choices. And they often get crystallised into a sexual position, sexuality position, which is unfortunate. There were vegans, you know, who absolutely saw the link between peace and veganism. There were people who were against multinationals, you know, that it was, because it was a single issue. Obviously, once we were all there, it broadened out into all these other implied constituents of that problem.
And so how and why do you think the decision was taken for Greenham to become women only?
Oh. God, it's funny, isn't it? We were asked this all the time, and now I'm just trying to sift through. I think women, so many women wanted to be with other women and their lives weren't conducive to that. There was a lot of discussion about the nuclear family and how that can carve you off from your female friendships. Not that you want that to happen, but because of time and sometimes because of influence from partners, husbands. Women were ready at that time to want to see and know the joy, really, of being with other women who felt the same. A lot of the women were in jobs and relationships where even there they didn't feel heard. And the cruise missile was almost like this kind of, you know, invasive penis in a way. I mean, that's how it was seen, that just symbolised that women were secondary in every area of life, even when it comes to the nurturing of the children. Why would you bring children up in a world that had that kind of weaponry? It didn't make sense. You know, people realised that there was a false consciousness about motherhood, a false consciousness where women would carry on having children knowing that we had international armaments. Made no sense to them.
Mm. And so what facilities were there at the camp for children?
Hardly any, but there was playfulness. And there were a lot of the women, you know, loved playing with children, and the children would help with repairing benders, making food. Children love to be involved. You know, if you make a fire, children are there and you're chatting. And I remember in my mind, I've got lots of scenes of different women taking on the childcare of different children. You know, there weren't ever a lot of children there, but children were welcome and participated, as far as I saw.
And were there any educational facilities?
Not that I knew of, but then you can't be at every gate and things.
And you were at all the gates? No. Not all of them, but no. Most of the gates you visited?
Yes, the main one obviously was Main Gate, Yellow Gate, and that was quite rough. And then there was Green Gate, which was kind of, you know, the opposite. And the other gates, when you're in a situation like that, you're in an extreme situation. Nights are nerve-wracking. People did come round, you know, locals came round to intimidate and sometimes hurt. That was ongoing. And that means that the people at the gate become very tight in how they run that gate. And so because I was an in and out person, I didn't have that access, you know, and I wouldn't have intruded. But Green Gate and Main Gate, I kind of had a place there.
So what was it like? Paint a picture for me of what it was like to spend a night then. Gates.
You'd arrive into chaos. I would arrive sort of early evening, usually. People were trying to find something to eat. There would be sometime, as I said, there was this fast running road Have you been to Greenham?
The area, yes.
This non-stop traffic, and you're getting hoots and shouts and hoorays, and, you know, you're getting interaction all the time. And there was always somebody trying to be there to respond, you know, so it wasn't just ignored. But there would be copious mud, a lot of kind of chaos around that time of people trying to get fed. I mean, you know, really, really difficult. And you would try to take sort of as many bags of fish and chips as you could possibly carry, you know, but it was never enough. Then people would be... people would always be walking around with sheaves of paper in their hand and pens and trying to work out how to respond to this. I mean, this little caravan from Dorset Peace Council became a sort of office. And how that functioned, I don't know, because we were sending press releases all over the world. We were taking notes of vigilante notes. We were trying to respond to letters. You know, when I say we, I wasn't actually doing that. I mean, the mainstay women. It was unbelievable. You were trying to run an organisation from mud and not knowing how you were going to eat. It really was like that. Quite heavily dependent on the locals who were good. They would sort of befriend a small group of people and take them to their house. Barbara Harford, who I worked on the book with, she bought a house there, and I know other women who did that as well. They bought houses in order that people could get respite and also become an office extension. So it was pretty chaotic. And then if people had got fed, and obviously there were cars there, and Greenham women would be going into town getting food, but you know that there wasn't any security about food or money at all. Nothing like that. You couldn't take anything for granted, you know, and people definitely went short of things. And then things would calm down as people got out. Then, you know, the fires would be, people would sit around the fire. Constant discussion. What should we do about this? What should we do about that? How will we do that? How do we look after somebody who's just, you know, can't take it anymore, or, you know, been arrested and come out? We were going up. I keep saying we, and I don't want to take credit for being, you know, there full time. This is sort of bits that I was involved in. You'd have to go up to Holloway. You know, there were people imprisoned. There were people in cells. There were people, you had to be aware of visitors who just arrived, who they might have arrived from Australia. You know, there were people coming from all over the world, not knowing what they were coming to. And they tried to have some sort of reception for people, you know, at least to say hello, come this way, try to get them a cup of tea. You know, that's how it was. It was hand to mouth, day to day, with this massive international kind of office-y organisation going on.
Stunning. And how were decisions made?
Oh. Well, different gates had different processes because they had different influences. Like, anarchist, Quaker, sort of ecological, different ethos existed at different gates. There were leaders who mainly kept themselves at main gate. Sometimes there was also a degree of autonomy where that was the kind of anarchist element to it. There were definite leaders who made decisions at different times. And then if you didn't agree, one option was to just go somewhere else, go to another gate perhaps, and follow a different course of action. Now, although it was a muddle, I think it was a fantastically progressive experiment in how do you make decisions. And when you look at our situation at this moment on the 16th of April 2019, we do not have a good decision process.
So in thinking about the Greenham decision process, yes, then, could you highlight some of the key,
yes,
methods which would be useful now?
Yes, okay. So there would be sort of general discussion about something, maybe. People would be involved, they'd be thinking about the answers, and there could be a show of hands, or there could be go round and round and round until there was actual consensus, like the North American Indian Lodge style of decision making. At other times, individuals who had leadership positions that were kind of agreed to took the decisions themselves. Some decisions had to be made immediately, you know, on the end of a phone or something, or in a police station. You know, I think every possible method of making decisions was going on there all the time. But there was a kind of impossible commitment to consensus. But it was really, really very, very difficult to bring that about. But from what I saw, that was the kind of hope.
Interesting. And so what sort of relationship did you or the other women have with the men around the camp, like the military or the police or the partners or the bailiffs?
Yes, okay. Oh, God. As soon as you say that, my body just sort of explodes. I remember one incident, which I'll talk about because it's quite theatrical, might be useful. At Greengate one night, it was quite a lot of us there, and this man turned up, a young man, quite scrawny, possibly a bit drunk, furious, with a stick in his hand, shouting. And I think we were either sitting quietly at the fire or actually in benders, and, you know, but anyway, he was quite threatening. Obviously, nobody knew what to do. But this is one of the wonderful things that happened at Greenham, was there was a collective instinct. And because things were so immediate, it was so immediately challenged in every kind of way, that this collective instinct, I think, was just a survival method. And what happened was, this man was rampaging and it was clear he was going to hurt somebody. And we all just made a circle around him and sang and sort of swayed and got nearer and nearer to him in a completely unified, unspoken way, so that the fear that we felt and the fear and distress that he clearly felt, otherwise he wouldn't be doing that, was kind of taken up in the rhythm of the song and the unthreatening movement to just hold him in a space. And we were moving and he was moving, and then we came to a place where we were all still, but we were all around him. And it was peaceful.
And what happened to him then?
I think he cried. And I hope that is the right memory. I think that's what happened. And he was looked after.
Do you remember what the song was?
Oh, what's it, feel the... Old and strong. No, I don't.
Never mind, if it floats in.
Yes. Yes. It was a typical one.
Yes, what a wonderful story.
It's a typical song. I could try and remember. But it was... It's always stayed in my mind. Because I thought... These women's actions understand disarmament. But how do you do that on the scale that we're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
The other memory I have about men was going there on a Wednesday night to fill in where there was a gap, really, to keep the fire working, basically. You only had to have two or three women, but the one I liked was being outside. I can't actually remember. It might have been Green Gate again. I'm not sure. But it was right up against the fence, keeping a fire going. And during the night, the men who were on duty in the base, they would come and sit the other side of the fence. And we'd get the fence up and pass things through. And I remember one night, they took a door down and broke it up for us to keep the fire going.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of holes in the fence. You know, this was nothing new. There were holes in the fence all over because, of course, we'd clippered it open for various things. And the sort of relationship was still happening with the men on the base. They didn't want to be there, the ones who talked to us, obviously. And then the next day, after a lovely meeting with these young boys who were the same age as some of the children of the mothers there, you know, would be saying that they didn't know what they got into and they were homesick. They wanted their mums. You know, it was so bound up and wrong. And and then the next day, you could be in the same place and you could meet somebody that was, you know, insulting you quite badly, you know, shouting at you, insulting you, you know, dirty whores and stuff like that, a lot worse than that. And you didn't know where you were.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of fitted with some of our experience of men. Which is why we felt they were unfit to be in this position of power, which is why we were there.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that some of the residents were very kind and supportive. So generally, what was the relationship like between the women and the local residents?
I was there when there was a... I wasn't at the gate, but when I woke up, it was skirmish in the middle of the night and there was methods of waking other... You know, you'd have runners to gates. There was bells, there was gongs. You know, there was things to saucepan, banging saucepan with wooden spoons. There was a lot of the stuff. If there was an invasion of people, and it might just be a car stops and a load of blokes get out, you know, and they sort of nose around, they think it's funny, and it just escalates horribly and all kinds of things. There would be methods of making noise that everybody would be drawn. There'd be gate runners going round. What I understood, but I didn't witness myself, but there were some people quite high up in the civic life of Newbury who were involved in violent vigilantes involving acid and rabbit entra, kind of, you know, filth. Very nasty. I don't know if that is true or not, but I did hear that repeatedly.
And you mentioned that you would gather around women who couldn't take it any longer, I think is what you said. What medical treatment was available in the camp for kind of physical and mental?
Yeah, I really don't know anything about that. I only know that women are wonderful with each other in terms of, you know, it is. I can see people with fingerless gloves, hand round a cup of tea, you know, completely ragged, hand round a cup of tea and somebody sitting next to them, rolling up a fag. And that, just the comfort of other women. I don't know anything broader than that, really.
And so I know that you were helping the Quakers and that's how you got involved with the project. did you actually spend any time in at their gate? I was just wondering about how their religious beliefs fit in with what's going on at Greenham.
No, I didn't really, because I was a teacher full time, and I was running a course at school called Protect and Survive, because I wanted to put politics and peace particularly on the curriculum. And I was running the CND, and I was then chair of Dorset Peace Council as well. And I was also doing non-violent direct action training for CND, because we were involved in that at Greenham. I was much more political than spiritual.
I have heard some of the women say that they used to hear the Quaker ladies going about their day and singing hymns.
Yes. I bet that would have been wonderful.
Yes.
Soothing and calming. And so, I mean, singing is a wonderful form of action.
Yes. And was there a lot of singing at the camp?
Yeah, particularly at the fires at night, you know, but it was a way of strengthening yourself, a way of coming together. You know, that the collective thing, even though there's always subgroups, the collective power of women was, it was, the word I want to say is it was orgasmic, because why I want to say that is that a lot of us hadn't experienced the collective power of women before, where women are totally in charge, and what they believe in, what they love, what they hope for comes together and is expressed together. That's why Greenham was so absolutely irresistibly magical. You know, all the time I was having to give reports back, because the women who, for one reason or another, couldn't get away were so hungry for that. It looked as if society deliberately divided us.
So it's interesting that you use the word magical, and so you've got the two extremes of the horror, the magic.
Yeah, there was a lot of magic there.
Yes. So how do you feel about the way Greenham has been represented in popular culture?
Is it in popular culture?
That may be the answer to the question. So how has it been represented? In films?
Well, obviously, one of my... that sort of motivated me to get the book off the ground.
Mm-hmm. And the title of the book is...
It's Greenham Common, Women at the Wire. And it has a wonderful hand-drawn cover, which I just adore, which gives you quite a lot of the atmosphere of Greenham, actually. But that was my worry. I was looking at it all, and I was writing my own notes, my own journal notes, obviously, because I had to talk about it. I was doing radio interviews, you know, this, that and the other. And always trying to make clear that this is just a personal view. You know, I would never think of trying to speak for the collective, because the thing was, you couldn't do that without excluding so many people. There was a lot of radio interest at the time, particularly around an event. And a lot of the interest was about perpetuating the idea of men and women being against each other. There wasn't so much interest in, like, questions you've asked about what was the decision making. What I found when I was talking to people in the media was, what goes wrong there? What are the problems there? It was problematizing. And we were solution focused, if we were anything. You know, we were full of faith and hope and clarity. And it was the media. They always want a bad story, don't they? And we got very misrepresented. And, you know, in other aspects of my life, I've been misrepresented by the media. I don't really have much faith in it at all. I don't think we ever got into popular culture, because a lot of women on the ground were even reluctant to own up that they supported Greenham because their lives didn't support it. The only reason I was able to be so involved and the people I lived around was because we had Dorset Peace Council that was Quaker led, and we had a very strong CND group. If you didn't have and weren't part of those things and you were on your own, you know, I'm finding now I'm going around talking about the Labour Party and people say I wouldn't dare vote Labour in my street. No, you know. So for a woman who was affiliated to Greenham, not always easy to own up. So I don't think it's ever been in popular culture. I think this project is going to be great in bringing people together again. It needs to happen now because a lot of us are getting on. And whenever I talk to young women through my work with Dreadnought about Greenham, they are absolutely fascinated. And it sparks a yearning. I think if this project could get it into the popular culture, it'd be pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little more about the book that you co-edited. How did that come about?
It came about because I was friends with Barbara, partly because I had physical disabilities, and sometimes when I was at Greenham, it was too much for me. You know, I was pulled out of a wheelchair and arrested on the telecom action and stuff like that. And she actually said, you know, come to my house and rest up a bit. So that was good. And I was talking to her because what I'd found was, I was thinking, God, there is so much happening here in terms of progressive politics, progressive feminism, in terms of women finding it impossible to get on, almost women meeting who had nothing in common. This is what was so extraordinary. This was the thing that opened my eyes, was how could you have women who were so different, you know, and their lives just weren't on the same map. And I just thought it was the whole idea of what woman was and could be and wanted to be hadn't even touched base. And I said to Barbara, this, nobody's writing this. She said, oh yeah, they're trying to, but they haven't got time. And I said, it needs an archive. It's got to have an archive. Let's do it. So she said, yeah, okay. Aggie Jakubska, who was at Greenham a lot of the time, and I and Barbara got together at my house in Dorchester and decided, yeah, we were going to do this. We put it to the women at Greenham. They went, you know, do it. Yeah, do what you like, you know, because we haven't got time. So we approached Women's Press. They wanted it straight away. That was it, really. We spent a year collecting material. A lot of women objected to it, and another book was written by Caroline Blackmore. I hope I've got her name right. I think I have. Which hopefully was the voice for the people who didn't like what we were doing.
What didn't they like about it?
We weren't radical enough, and that wasn't our intention either. Our intention was to archive as much as we could about women's experience there, trying not to be partisan. And we wanted it to include the radicals, but their separatism meant that they couldn't be in a book like that, you know. And this sort of crystallised a lot of the ongoing dilemmas there, you know. To what extent, if you are a separatist, how far do you go? It was all about how far do you go, really. You could sum it up. How far do you go as a pacifist, as a vegetarian, as a mother? As a mother, that was really hard. As a woman with professional commitments, you know, I had a commitment to the pupils I taught as well. It wasn't good for me to get injured, you know, that kind of stuff.
And the book is still available.
Well, it's out of print, and there are some copies you can get secondhand on Amazon. I had to get some recently, and it's quite hard, actually. It was translated into Japanese, but it would be... I really hoped it would be translated into German, because there was the Green Movement there was so strong at the time. But a European translation would be good. So I would be... I'd have to get in touch with Barbara, but I think if a European translation came up, that would be good. Mm-hmm. Maybe to go alongside what you're planning, because there is an appetite for this. There's an appetite for the idea of women being together, because we've got separated again. And that's what we're finding in Dreadnought. People have a hunger to have that woman-only belonging.
So what tactics from Greenham do you still see at play in activism and politics today?
I think women being at the front of protest, that's been clear, you know, in the climate change and also in the Remain and Reform movement. I think the fact that women were strengthened by either being part of Greenham or seeing other women do that has had a absolute infinite effect on people in my generation. I agree with you that I don't think it's sifted down, but daughters, you know, my daughter, who I didn't have at the time, she knows all about it, you know, it has sifted down. So there's that. There's the example of women being at the front. I think singing and collective peaceful action to bring about peaceful action is important. I was, one of the actions I was involved in was against telecom, and it was called the Telecom Five. I think there were five of us. And no, BT or Telecom, I can't remember. Anyway, we went to the shareholders meeting, and we all positioned ourselves among the shareholders in different places, and we all had different things to say about, did the shareholders realise the impact of their shares, you know, on future peace, on the chances of a multilateral disarmament even? Did they realise that women at Greenham were being abused, you know, and hurt by people? And the meeting was shut down. It didn't get... There wasn't antagonism, but I do remember the meeting was shut down, and we managed to get ourselves into the next phase, which was the buffet. And we decided to carry on just conversing with people. And I remember I was talking to these two old ladies who grabbed some vol-au-vents, and I watched them sort of stuff them in their mouth, and then they just spat the whole lot in my face.
Oh.
And, you know, you dirty woman, you know, all that sort of thing.
So why do you think it is that the suffragettes seem to have a different reputation from the women at Greenham Common?
I think because the women at Greenham Common had left their lives. That's very threatening. Very threatening to their families, their workplaces, to society as a whole, that women might up and go for something critical. The suffragettes, because they stayed where they were, they had the advantage of being able to have much better organisation. Greenham was never an organisation, it was a presence, and that's very different. And the conditions at Greenham were sacrificial, you know, it was very very tough and hard.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think the police and the lawmakers learnt from Greenham?
What they learnt?
What they learnt.
Well, my experience of the police there was misogyny, straightforward misogyny. I mean, they were talking to you all the time in vile terms. You know, that they would have wrenched limbs off if they could have done. This is just my experience, you know. I was absolutely horrified. I remember a couple of actions where I wasn't in a wheelchair, but I had a walking stick, you know, and still. And I did sort of expect that to have a helpful effect, you know, but absolutely not. You know, I was thrown to the ground. I was dragged. Obviously.
Dragged out of your wheelchair?
No, I wasn't in the wheelchair at that point. I just had a walking stick.
Yes.
But that made no difference whatsoever. It was absolutely horrible. They used to throw people into the vans in a way that would hurt them. Pulling hair, pulling breasts. You know, really, really horrible.
How do you think that has changed?
It still happens. And for some people it's changed. I'm trying to think what action I've been recently. How has it changed? I think there is such a fear of women acting collectively and independently to undo the male stronghold. There is such a fear of it. You know, we've got a long way to go. I'm sorry if that sounds pessimistic. That's what I see and what I hear.
And so how do you think your Greenham experience has impacted on your personal life then and today?
Well, at that time, how it impacted it? I was in... Everything just sort of took off, escalated, because there was this hunger for what's happening at Greenham. How can we help? What's going on, you know? What do I do? Do I stay at home and look after my children? Do I go to Greenham? Do I risk arrest? You know, a lot of heartache about that. And I wasn't a mother at the time, but I was caught in the dilemmas of women then. And I was teaching at an all boys school. So it was terribly interesting. And they knew I was involved because it was in the papers and all that sort of thing. And I was doing debates in the local Corn Exchange with the local MP, Jim Spicer, and with a doctor who I'm sure you know, Dr. Lynn Jones, who was very, very strong and key at Greenham. So in terms of my life, you know, there was not a moment to spare, really. I also could see my assumptions as a woman were wrong, which is so limited, so petty. I think it expiated a pettiness for me.
In what way did you think they were wrong?
Oh, just in terms of being petty.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of things I'd not thought about. I hadn't seen the scope of what women are doing all over the world. I wasn't really aware of how we express ourselves in such diverse ways. Also, I wasn't aware how global was the feeling of women being held down. That was astonishing. Held down in their own bodies, you know, as well as having your own body held down. Held down sexually, held down emotionally, held down materially, held down in every aspect of life. And this was a sort of dust out, really. And, you know, if we'd been able to, there were attempts to get, we had the Greenham offices at some times, you know, there was one in London. But if we'd been able to do the presence at the camp and organise, anything could have happened, actually. Anything could have happened socially. But there wasn't the resources.
So how has that all affected what you're doing now?
Right, okay. You're never the same after Greenham, really, even if it's just a visit. My brother came to visit once, and he still remembers it. He has immense admiration for it. He felt, he could feel the power of it. He was only about 14. He could feel the power of it. It frightened him. I mean, there was also a wildness about a lot of the women there that was very empowering and very frightening to people. The feral and the tame, you know. And now I think this is, that background is why I'm now a trustee with Dreadnought, because you can't look back, because you realise through doing an action like that how much work there is to do. It's not stoppable. And you also realise that really your tribe is women.
Tell me a little bit about Dreadnought.
Okay. Dreadnought Southwest was set up 4 or 5 years ago. We're based in Exeter. There's two co-directors, Josie Sutcliffe and Natalie McGrath. And it's to do with this very thing, making sure that women's voices, women's narratives are in the public domain and in the cultural narrative in every aspect of our lives. So what we do is anything to do with women speaking up and expressing themselves through the arts media. So one of our main actions is called Occupy the Airwaves, which happens every International Women's Day. And women have taken over the radio programme for Exeter from 8 in the morning till midnight. And it's full of women's features, women's interviews, women's music, you know, the whole thing. And we train young women to be able to broadcast. And that has grown and grown and grown because it's such an attractive event, isn't it? And you reach people who can't come to other events. And it's wonderful to train young people to have a forum to get their voice heard. We also have a Rebellious Sounds archive, which was to commemorate the suffragists last year, where we have found over 50 activists who tell their activist story. And some of those stories have never been heard. Even the woman who speaks has not heard herself tell that story that has remained with her as sort of crucial part of her life experience. And it might be on a very personal level, or it could be in the workplace, or it could be politicised. We also do make badges and banners and flags where women can express their thoughts and hopes and join that collective again, creating the collective where women speak. It's women's ideas, women's views, women's perspectives, women's hopes, women's energy, women's love is brought together and shared and put more in the public domain.
Sounds like fascinating work and very necessary.
Mm.
And so is there a question that about Greenham that you wished that you'd been asked?
I suppose for me, the same reason as wanting to edit the book is I feel it needs to have a presence in our culture, in the form of a museum or I know there's an archive. I don't feel it's that publicly known of. And this is history. Greenham is absolute history, you know, crucial history. Now we've got so much history teaching being limited, particularly with a cutting down of historical women figures being taken out of the curriculum. I feel it needs either an annual celebration, like International Greenham Day, something like that, or a museum, or an online museum, you know, because all of us there, thousands and thousands of women, have sisters, daughters, nieces, grandchildren who are part of Greenham now. And it's relevant to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the spider's web symbol of Greenham. Let's keep that strong and alive.
So what would be the message that you would want to get out to the younger generation then in a if you were preparing a history lesson, what is the key message that you would want to send to younger people?
Listen to what women... Listen to women. So clear as that. Listen to women. Make sure women are included in and have power in every aspect of life. And...
No, I can't say that.
Support women to have power without having to emulate masculine expressions of power. Support women to find their own informed power.
Sounds like an excellent, powerful message to get over there. So, before we close, is there one last story that perhaps come into your mind as we've been talking about your experience? Do you have one last story to share?
Well, nothing comes to mind particularly, but something I've noticed is that there still is a quiet respect for Greenham, that it sometimes comes up in conversation or if I'm writing something, that I have been involved in Greenham. And there is a respect, and I think there's still a hunger, and this is why I think it needs somewhere to go, somewhere to build.